Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Ohio House has approved a bill that, in the spirit of free expression, would extend to religious expression in assignments, prayer, artwork, and clothing in public schools. Critics have said that the bill could require teachers to give credit for inaccurate answers that are part and parcel of a student's religious beliefs. They say that the U.S. Constitution and state law already protect religious expression in schools, meaning this bill is unnecessary. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We're going to talk about that and much more today. Joining us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Daryl Rowland, Public Affairs Editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Happy Ishigan Week, Ann.
Jesse Ballmert is a state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Ishigan Week. What have we come to? All right. So the Ohio House has approved a bill that would protect students' rights to religious expression in public schools. Andy Chow, some people say this, the resistance to this measure has been overblown. But on the other hand, is this bill necessary?
Well,
do we know?
Critics of this bill have said that this is a redundant piece of legislation, that the protections that it would add into state law are already in state law, and that in any case it would potentially just add more confusion. And this is what we see when we're talking about bills that sort of double down on something that's already in state code, is that sometimes these bills become just an attempt by a legislator or a group of legislators to sort of send a signal to their base like, hey, we're working on this issue, even though that issue's already been resolved. And so if a bill is redundant and it does add confusion, then it has the potential to lead to lawsuits in the future where, the discussion has been brought up that, does this bill mean that if a student who believes in creationism could say on a test about evolution that the Earth is 6,000 years old, which if you're studying evolution would be incorrect, would a teacher have to mark that answer as correct? Supporters of the bill—
Because it's a part of their religious beliefs.
Because it's a part of their religious beliefs. They're saying, no, a teacher can still mark that incorrect because— based on what they are teaching the students, it's incorrect.
The sponsor of the legislation, Daryl Rowland, said that it was introduced for clarity, to clarify. Has there been questions about the clarity of free expression in schools thus far?
Perhaps so. To say this is not a new controversy is, like, I think, pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. I mean, even way back in the Clinton administration, there were directives from the feds to local school districts, what you can and cannot do. And that was in response to, I think what maybe some state officials are seeing is that local school officials have become almost paranoid to let almost any religious expression come forth. Or perhaps that is the fear, at least. So there's an overreaction that way. Well, then is this an overreaction the other way? You know, we as a culture, as a society, struggle to get this right with, you know, protecting everyone's First Amendment freedoms and all that. You know, I look at it. I mean, the scenario that Andy described certainly is the worst case scenario of opponents. I like Jesse and Andy, they probably got the news release. I think it was actually from a Catholic school association. So this isn't even a public school. This is a private school. Talked about, you know, we teach evolution, and the right answer to what is the theory of evolution is not the young earth creationism theory. It is, you know, natural selection and all that. Now, that's not saying you have to believe that or whatever, but you have to give a scientifically accurate response. I think the only thing clear that this bill clearly changes, perhaps, and again, these guys have covered it firsthand more so than I have, is that this would broaden specifically that you can't be limited to sort of non-classroom hours, like lunch hours and after school. Mm-hmm. You're allowed religious expression the rest of the time. Sort of keep your mouth shut. This would specifically broaden that, which may or may not open up a whole new set of problems or not. But again, I'm sure Jesse and Andy can elaborate on that.
Yeah, Jesse.
Yeah, I think that was one criticism brought up by Democrats was, you know, perhaps this would eat into classroom time in some way. It's not clear how much time that would take up or what have you. Regardless, this bill passed along a party line vote, basically. So it's now going to be in the Senate, and they'll decide whether they want to take it up. And so I think largely a lot of this is protected by the First Amendment and so forth. And so it's a question of whether this is needed. But certainly I'm sure you could find a couple, you know, certain incidences where students felt like they couldn't express their religion in the middle of the classroom.
They didn't feel comfortable.
Or didn't feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. So that could be what this is getting at. I think what's important to clear up is it appears that this wouldn't allow students to put
inaccurate answers
on their tests.
Andy?
I think it's important to bring up that a lot of the scenarios we've talked about are based out of the Christian faith, but what have been brought up in hearings and everything is also based on people who are Muslim, people who are Jewish. So let's say, like, if a student who is Muslim wants prayer time during instructional time, that's a question that'll come up. Should a teacher allow that student to be able to find a space to pray? I think that's a question that'll come up. I think mm-hmm. this bill sort of does address that. So if a student does maybe have a daily situation where they want to pray at 10 a.m. every morning, mm-hmm. I think a school might be required to allow that time. That's one of the questions that have come up. Again, another thing is attire. So if a student wants to wear a certain outfit because of their religious expression, the school needs to make room for that in some way. To allow that in some way.
Okay. Well, we'll see how it proceeds going forward. It's still headed to the Senate, and you know, there's a lot of stuff headed to the Senate, so who knows when they're going to get to it.
And this is a bill that has passed out of the House before and then I believe did not go anywhere in the Senate.
So. Right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Andy Chow, the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also with us, Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer and Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch. There, Daryl, you wrote about how state Democrats last week touted their family-friendly bills versus the Republicans' push for an all-out abortion ban in Ohio and those religious rights in schools kind of a thing. How is this playing? You know, this what define these sides for us and what it all means.
Well, sure. This is the Democrats obviously see an opportunity to appeal to what they feel are more mainstream Ohio voters and constituents. They certainly portray the you refer to the abortion ban. It's basically 100% abortion ban. There's a very narrow exception for life of mother, but
not even, for incest or rape or anything like that.
Right, right. Or health of mother.
Or health. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And there's even some
interesting.
There's even provision within that life of mother. If there's an ectopic pregnancy, they have to try to reimplant, which every source, including a group of Christian gynecologists and that I looked at, said, yeah, that's scientifically impossible. Speaking of bad science, now that is bad medical science from what I have, you know, read everywhere. And in fact, that could easily be fatal to the mother. So that could endanger the life of the mother. So when it goes to that extent, the Democrats say, you know, most of Ohioans, first of all, political polls, love them or hate them, show that Ohioans are primarily pro-choice. They do not favor overturning Roe versus Wade. This would legislate overturning Roe versus Wade. Now, of course, this would never go into effect in Ohio until we had years of court litigation and the Supreme Court would have to essentially overturn Roe versus Wade, or at least 95% of it, for this ever to become law. So in some ways, it's academic. So the Democrat has come back, and Democrats with lots of female leadership, Amelia Sykes, the minority leader in the House, you know, Kristen Boggs, the assistant minority leader from Columbus here. So they're saying, well, let's talk about family leave and things like that, and affordable college, and to paying for child care, things that are, they deem, more family-friendly than banning abortion or, you know, the failure to, from their perspective, to move on gun rights legislation or gun violence legislation. So they're saying, yeah, this is going to be more palatable to the public. And it's, Democrats are in an interesting position because, again, they're in such small minority, they can't really move the needle very much. They do have a little more power this time in that they've cut a deal to make Larry Householder speaker. So he's looking at them more friendly, but he's also giving them the caveat, yeah, you're not getting anything on abortion or these big issues that you want either. So So it's kind of political, and it may be a little bit more of a long-term strategy saying, hey, Ohio, it's Republicans are the far-out extremists, not us Democrats. We're doing family-friendly stuff. We'll see how it plays.
It's been interesting to me because so far on the really controversial bills that have passed, the budget, raising the gas tax, House Bill 6, which, provided some subsidies for nuclear plants in northern Ohio. Those have really passed with some Republicans and some Democrats supporting them, some Republicans and some Democrats opposing them. The one really controversial bill that's passed along party lines was the heartbeat bill, or the 6-week abortion ban, which would ban abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected earlier this year. And so this
did not go into effect because of litigation.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's currently being held up because of a federal lawsuit. And so really, this is the one issue that Democrats can draw the line on the sand and say this is something they were absolutely against. And so when an even, more controversial, more extreme version of this bill comes out to ban all abortions, potentially charge both the doctor and the woman with murder, or in some cases aggravated murder, which carries a death penalty sentence, possibly comes out, they can certainly say, we're against this. This is too far for the average person in Ohio, too far for those suburban voters who they're looking to, swing over to their side on both the presidential and state house elections in 2020. And so, this is one topic that I think the Democrats think they can woo those moderate voters on. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the focus, we all have known this to be a bill that would be a total abortion ban. The actual name of the bill spells out that this creates an abortion capital murder offense. And so, like Jesse just said, it expands the ability for the state to execute people based off of abortions. And so that's not only gaining the attention of the normal parties, the regular people, so the anti-abortion people and the abortion rights groups, but also people who are against the death penalty are speaking out against it too, because it creates another penalty that can lead to executions.
And I think you'll see Ohio Right to Life, which is a anti-abortion lobbying group, and then I believe even Governor Mike DeWine have pointed out that this heartbeat bill ban is already going through the court system. There are multiple abortion-related legal challenges going through the courts right now, both in Ohio and, across the nation. And mm-hmm. So getting this in the pipeline really would be several months after the other legislation that's already moving forward. If your goal is to overturn Roe v. Wade, this isn't really necessary.
Mm-hmm. I think it kind of spells out the state house is sort of in this interesting transition period, I think. When we talk about the heartbeat bill or the 6-week abortion ban, that's something that's usually floating around the state house for all 2 years of the session. And then that's the main talking point until lame duck. And then the legislature either votes it out or doesn't vote it out. But instead, it was voted out super early in the 2-year session. Mm-hmm. So now we have these more extreme right, more conservative bills coming out that even somebody like Mike DeWine, who's always been a staunch opponent to abortion, mm-hmm. is kind of forced to pump the brakes and say, well, listen, we've already passed the heartbeat bill. Let's wait to see what the courts say on that. I think our focus should be on waiting for the courts. And so we're seeing these bills come out that are even more extreme because we've already seen the legislature pass these bills.
Right. So, Daryl Rowland, what does that say to you? I mean, that it's coming out so early in the session, that there are more of these kinds of bills?
Yeah. Well, I talked to the main supporter. Interestingly, it's not Right to Life who's supporting this. They are.
Well, they didn't support the 6-week ban either at first.
Right.
Until it became
so they were sort of recent converts to that. Mm-hmm. So maybe we have a parallel situation here. But yeah, the Ohio Right to Life is officially positioned. They will neither support nor oppose this new proposal because they have put their money in the heartbeat bill ban as being the vehicle they think can overturn Roe versus Wade. And, we'll see whether that pays off. But within the Right to Life community in Ohio, there's always been a group that's more ardent than the official statewide group. Groups in Dayton and Cincinnati and Cleveland, sometimes Toledo. And that is this coalition that we are seeing here. They're saying, you're not going far enough, Right to Life. officially. So we're going to get together. And they got, you know, close to 24 co-sponsors on this. So it's not like just one or two person sponsoring this bill. So they're saying that. They're saying, okay, Heartbeat was great. We pushed for that for years. But now it is time to do what we've always wanted to do all along. Let's just ban this. Why, you know, Heartbeat bill, it essentially banned it at, whatever, 6 to 8 weeks of pregnancy. Let's just move it back to, you know, conception, basically. Interestingly, a spokesman for Larry Alboff I talked to says he wouldn't commit one way or another on a bill, but did note that he regards himself as a very pro-life Senate president and that the Senate is the most pro-life legislative body like in the country or something like that, which I don't know. How's that sound to you, Ann? That sounds like this may be looked at favorably by the entire chamber.
And given that they have another year in the session, they have plenty of time to mull it.
Yep.
Well, and, you know, you have people jockeying for various spots where they're going to wind up. Senate President Alboff is term limited, so he is done in the Ohio Senate at the end of next year. There are some thoughts he would run for Congress. The incumbent congressman, first perhaps, was not going to run, Bob Gibbs. Mm-hmm. Now he supposedly is. And, you know, the filing deadline for that is like less than a month away. So it's not like there's these long-range calculations. There's like, he's not going to wait till the end of his term and say, right, what should I do now? There's calculation going – well, there's always calculation going on at the State House, but especially so now. We're like 3 weeks out from the filing deadline. If you're going to run for Congress, if you're going to run for another legislative seat, you got to tell us before Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Jesse?
As far as those calculations go, I think, you know, as the Cincinnati representative, I'll point out that one of the sponsors on this bill is Representative Candace Keller, who is running for an Ohio Senate seat. And really, most of her campaign is based on being, you know, anti-abortion access, pro-life legislator. So I think the timing is not coincidental.
And she is not the endorsed candidate in that race, of course, either. In fact, as I recall, the state Republican chairman asked her to step down.
Mm-hmm. Step away. Mm-hmm. Step away. We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Jesse Baumert of the State House Bureau for the Cincinnati Inquirer and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at WOSU.org/Rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland, and Cincinnati Inquirer State Government Reporter Jesse Baumert. The Stand Your Ground bill got its first hearing in the Ohio Senate. Andy Chow, you said that at the heart of the debate is whether the law would increase or decrease safety.
Yes. And so just to get everybody up to speed, the Stand Your Ground bill is a piece of legislation that would remove what's known as the duty to retreat when somebody finds themselves in a threatening situation. If that person wants to use lethal force or basically shoot the aggressor, that person first has a duty to retreat, has a duty to get out of the situation or try to de-escalate the situation in some way. This bill would remove the duty to retreat, making it easier for you to shoot somebody in self-defense.
You have a defense of
In court.
Yeah, in court.
And that's actually where all this boils down to is the argument is, okay, so let's say somebody thinks that they have the right to shoot someone in self-defense, and it turns out through the court system that no, they still did not. By that point, even though the court rules against that person, somebody's dead. And that's sort of at the heart of the argument from the Democrats, is that they believe that it'll just make it too easy in somebody's mind to take that kind of action. So right now, if somebody goes to get their concealed carry license, this is something that all those people are taught. Everybody who's going in for a license, they're taught about the stand your ground laws. They're taught about the duty to retreat. It's something that's built into the instruction of that. And so Democrats are worried that if you take that instruction away, if you take away that kind of extra support, that it could lead to more shooting deaths that could have been avoided.
You know, all of this comes up and is being raised in the wake of Governor Mike DeWine's gun reform proposal that apparently it just feels like it's completely lost any steam that it had.
We've had a couple of hearings on it. Senator Dolan is sponsoring it, obviously in the Senate. We're coming up on, what is it, 4 months
since the mass shooting
in Dayton, the crowd crying, do something. Governor DeWine had a response. Obviously, a lot of that was already in the works. But like 2 days later, had like a 17-point plan. Took a couple months for that to take the form of legislation, but that's where we are now. Speaker Householder has spoken very negatively on the governor's proposal. Senate President Aboff has expressed great reluctance.
It was introduced into the Senate, by the way, right?
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. It was thought that that was the
intentionally
perhaps the easier chamber.
Right.
But, you know, I realize these are just two people, but I think most of folks out there listening know that you have the Senate President against you, you've got the Speaker of the House against you. Boy, that's incredibly uphill. So we'll see if there's any way to amend that and still preserve anything of substance. You know, this has already been watered down far beyond what many gun control advocates say is really needed in this country. I mean, no mandatory background checks, no red flag law. Instead, the red flag has faded to a pink slip. Mm-hmm. We're not going to take your guns from the people. We're going to basically take the people from the guns and institutionalize them.
You know, Jesse Balmert, I was out at Farmers Market on Sunday, and they were passing, you know, they're collecting signatures to put something on the ballot.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of gaining steam on that. Their groups are coalescing.
Yeah. This group, I think, basically would be an initiated statute. So they would send it to the lawmakers and say, we would like to have universal background checks, essentially. And then the lawmakers would have the opportunity to move on it or not. I think based on what they've done on other similar legislation, if you're a guessing person, you would say they would not move on it. And then it would go to the voters on the 2020 ballot. And I know initially this was a concern for Republicans that this is an issue that, again, those suburban voters might be opposed. You know, there's a lot of polling that says there's widespread support for universal background checks, and this is something that maybe people would go to the polls and vote for if it was on the ballot. And so it's possible that this will end up on your ballot in 2020. I think that's maybe one way to do something if the legislature ends up not doing something. I think to the governor's bill, you see the challenge in it on something like the background check proposal in this is essentially it's not universal background checks, but it increases the penalty for those who purchase a gun for someone who's not permitted to have one. It also makes it easier to prosecute someone who sells a gun to someone who isn't permitted to have one. And so on one side, the Republicans say, oh, no, this is essentially universal background checks. Like we don't want to penalize people this much. And then you have Moms Demand Action and Democrats on the other side saying, well, this isn't universal background checks. This isn't going far enough. So one proposal is pleasing no one.
DeWine said that when he if he were to put out a piece of legislation to regulate guns, that it had to be something that was constitutional, that would be effective and would pass the legislature. And I think that last tenet, the being able to pass a legislature is why it is what it is, why it is basically a boiled down.
But even that can't pass the legislature at this point.
Right. And I think that's where the group that you're talking about, the ballot initiative group, is saying, listen, every poll that ever comes out from any group, it says that about 90% of Ohioans want universal background checks. So why not just put it on the ballot? And so this is a way for them to give it to the legislature first and say, hey, do this thing that 90% of Ohioans want. And if you don't, we'll just go to the polls and do it.
This, and people wonder, why is that, that such a high percentage of Ohioans support these elements of gun control, and yet the Ohio General Assembly responds with more, with more leniency when it comes to gun ownership. And some people say, well, you got to follow the money and that kind of thing. But the NRA does not necessarily spend that much money. What is it that the NRA has that they lord over lawmakers?
Ardent people. Mm-hmm. You're right.
The endorsements is what I would.
Well,
I think sample ballots.
Sample, yeah.
We're talking about abortion. We're talking about gun rights. It's like, here we are. The two most volatile issues in our society today, especially gun rights groups, have shown a very strong power to mobilize their folks, get them to the polls, and even in Republican primaries have an outsized influence on what their numbers may actually be, very organized. And but it's not, it's a little bit non-traditional where now, again, we're talking about state and local level. There's not that much money. Now, federal level, it's a different story, of course. It's just mobilizing people and even sending in postcards or whatever, mm-hmm. and flooding, people with calls or emails or whatever.
It's the effort. It's the grassroots effort on the local level. And I think being supported or being endorsed by the NRA is just code for people. Like, that's what they look for. And then all you have to see is, oh, this person's backed by the NRA. Then this is the person I want to be representing me in the legislature.
I do also think there's just different opinions about guns in different parts of the state. I think if you're from a more rural area, you're a hunter, this is part of kind of your culture and part of, you're going out on Thanksgiving and, mm-hmm. and so forth. Whereas maybe if you grew up in the city or in the suburbs, that's less so. If you had had a traumatic experience where somebody had burglarized your house, you might be much more willing to have a gun or something like that. So I think just perhaps the areas that some of these lawmakers are from, Speaker Householder is from Perry County. One of the biggest fundraisers for the county fair every year is a gun bash. I just think there's a different perspective about firearms in different parts of the state, too.
I think there are two other things to note about this is that there are a lot of gun owners who support background checks because they want they take gun ownership very seriously. They understand the responsibility of owning a gun, and they want everybody up to measure up. They want everybody else to measure up to that too. I think another thing, going back to the polls that show that 90% of people want universal background checks, I think what we don't know is just how important do they find that issue. Is it so important to the 90% that they're willing to vote on that issue, that they're willing to vote for a representative based on that issue, or is it just something they want, mm-hmm. but it's not the biggest deal to them? Mm.
Speaking of Larry Householder, I wanted to talk briefly about his proposal to pool all of local revenue for property tax revenue for schools and then dish it out to the most needy. I mean, that's the most socialistic thing I've ever heard Republicans say. What is going on with him?
Spread the money around? Redistribution of wealth?
Redistribution of wealth, yeah.
I was
flummoxed when I heard that.
I first heard these proposals. I think it was when Voinovich first ran for office, like in 1990, there was talk about this, way before DeRolf.
Well, yeah, there's
and
always been talk about it, but to hear Larry Householder say it, you hear himself?
Speaker Householder, Jesse just pointed out where he's from. He's from Perry County.
Yeah.
He's from the home district, though, that filed the DeRolf school funding litigation. And he's, he has been supportive of the Cupp-Patterson effort. This is like the great hope in the legislature that, hey, now we're finally going to get this school funding thing right. Long way to go, but the proposal's there. A lot of the the main criticism, however, is how the money is divvied up.
Mm-hmm.
And Speaker Householder has been one of the main critics, basically saying poor districts are not getting enough. You need to do even more. So there was a proposal in the last committee hearing to, okay, let's give poor districts some more. And it would have, I don't know, been like $300-400 million on top of what is already estimated as a $1.5 billion package. So now we're sneaking towards $2 billion, and no one's saying where the money's going to come from, except maybe this idea. It's, yeah, just pool it all at the state level. But, you know, in some ways, that's already happening with revenue, in that you look at how districts are funded, and the poorer districts are being funded 80, sometimes
right,
as much as
90%
from the state.
You bring in at the local level, the more you get from the state. Yeah, that's true.
Whereas
but
the more, you know, affluent districts, your Upper Arlingtons and a lot of your Olentangies are getting a small percentage of their funding from the state because they have more affluent
right.
taxpayers. So in a way, it's already been going on,
right?
But not to this extent.
Well, not so bluntly. It's always been going on.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting. I mean, there actually are at least a few states that do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Wyoming has been doing it for a while this
Much
manner.
Less populous, of course. Very different.
Much less populous, but not exactly what you would call like a socialist, you
no.
know, like democratic leaning
yeah.
state. So it intrigues me just that it has worked there. But I do think sometimes the speaker likes to just like float ideas out. And so maybe
That's
this was one he wanted to
idea.
Have.
I think it just kind of pokes the bear a little bit to get things moving. If mm-hmm. if there's a stalemate or if something starts to slow down, it is on brand for him to the speaker to just kind of throw something out there to sort of regenerate talks on something to get things going again. I mean, we saw with the gas tax where it seemed like there was just a stalemate and nothing was going on, and so he says a little something to sort of poke somebody else a little bit, and it gets things moving again.
Well, we will take a quick break. We'll get this moving again when we come back. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us, Daryl Rowland of the Dispatch and Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland, Cincinnati Enquirer State Government Reporter Jesse Ballmert, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Reporter Andy Chow. All right, so the public impeachment hearings are over for now, all things being equal, but Daryl Rowland, you wrote about how the quid pro quo testimony last week hasn't changed any minds among Ohioans in Congress. We know that that's pretty much the case across Congress at this point.
Right.
No surprise there.
Or
did you think it might?
Who knows? It's been.
It's not the trial.
I guess
part
I've
of
sort
it
of.
All.
Well, right. I guess I reserve judgment. You know. Well, I think a lot of people, well, there's complaints about the secret hearings in a basement. Now let's let them testify openly.
I thought it was a dungeon. Wait a minute.
Well, whatever. But, you know, you do have President Trump's own ambassador to the area talking about, yes, there was a quid pro quo. Now, the Republicans point out, say, well, those words, you know, those instructions did not come from Donald Trump's lips. In fact, late in the process, he told him no quid pro quo. Now, that was after the whistleblower's report had been made, and the House and Senate were already launching an investigation. So, interestingly, the ambassador said he did not judge whether that was true or not. And he also testified that still the president of Ukraine needed to, quote, clean some things up. I don't know. But that was a little bit of mud. And, of course, Republicans seized on that, as you would expect people defending the president to do, and say, see, it's hearsay, it's your speculation, it's this, it's that. Some might have thought someone that Trump himself appointed, acknowledging there's quid pro quo, and these accounts were supported by several other witnesses, to the extent they heard them over the phone or whatever. But you're right, it has not seemingly moved the needle. Now, there have been some people that have been really quiet. Steve Stivers has not spoken out on this issue in like a month. You call his office and try to get comment, and it's, I don't know if he's dead or alive, to be honest with you. He's not telling his constituents where he stands, one way or the other. And, it doesn't matter to us, but it'd be nice to maybe do your due diligence and tell the people who put you in Congress to make tough decisions where you're coming from on this issue, especially since you're part of the military. I'm interested to say, and Rob Portman has been fairly quiet recently as well, because he's one that's, he could almost potentially be called as a witness, mm-hmm. because he is one who's, Ukraine. He's been over there. He is, the co-leader of the Senate Ukraine caucus. It's been a passion of his on getting arms to the Ukraines. Has been one of his issues. He criticized Obama severely mm-hmm. for not providing arms, but providing other sorts of aid, non-lethal aid. So he was ecstatic when Congress officially approved it, and then weeks and months passed, he was questioning the administration, why aren't they getting the money? And, it almost came down to push came to shove. They needed to appropriate this by the end of September or it would expire at the end of the federal fiscal year. He never got a good answer. At least this is what he has told reporters mm-hmm. From the Secretary of Defense, from the Vice President himself. So very high-ranking officials wouldn't say one or another why it's being held up. Till right at the end, it was on the evening of 9/11 this year, when he talked to the president himself, and the president said he's releasing the money. And the reason given at that time was he wanted other European countries to pay more. Now, okay, wouldn't we all, and, Senator Portman said, yeah, that'd be a nice goal. Now, you notice that defense has just totally disappeared.
Yeah.
It's all been, he was actually wanting to go after corruption. Well, the administration had already certified there was no corruption. That was a precursor for voting for this aid in the first place. So we have a muddled mess here. And this seems to be people are so locked in, they're just not moving. I covered a kind of a pitiful protest, to be honest with you. Friday afternoon, 3 dozen people showed up out in front of the State House. It was chilly. It was windy, whatever. But still, about, 35 people to call for the impeachment and removal of President Trump. And it was mostly the folks in the resistance movement are frequently protesting and going to members of Congress's office, Senator Portman's office, whatever. But, they just didn't – there's just didn't appear to be – much of a muster. And again, Jesse and Andy can talk about it. There's really not much talk at the State House either about this.
Yeah, there are some national issues that the State House folks really like to jump on and make their issue. I mean, honestly, we've maybe talked more about the replacement to NAFTA than about impeachment recently. And so I think especially Democrats see these other issues that we talked about, guns and abortion, as, topics that they can win over voters more on than impeachment. It is a little odd that they aren't talking too much about it, but I know when we asked Governor Mike DeWine about some of this at an editorial board for the Inquirer, mm-hmm. he was very quick to say, I want to talk about the gun bill. I want to talk about these other things. I don't want to talk about this.
Well, there is a lot to talk about in Ohio, as there is the rest of the country. So, but there's also a calculation here, right? It's early to start taking sides when you're a state lawmaker.
Right. I was going to say, although it would be unusual, it's not unheard of for House Democrats and House and Senate Democrats to talk about national issues. When it comes to the border crisis and separating families, a lot of them were quick to jump mm-hmm. on that. But when it comes to talking about impeachment, I think a lot of people, especially Democrats who live in districts that they have to sort of calculate if there are Trump supporters within that district, and so they don't want to pick one side or another on that so quickly. I think it's a hot button topic politically for both parties, and they're trying to figure out what they need to do. And I think they're just making the decision that, hey, they're on the state level. They're not really being asked to make a decision one way or another, so they're staying out of it. I also wonder, nationally, is there will fatigue set in when it comes to impeachment and impeachment hearings where, yes, people are watching and people want to know about it, but at some point, especially when we talk about the presidential campaigns, the Democratic presidential campaign, at some point, when do people who are looking for a Democratic candidate, do they want to just hear what that Democratic candidate will do, not necessarily how that Democratic candidate stacks up against President
Trump?
It's
hard to know because there isn't any kind of template for this timing of this. Usually, I guess in the Clinton case and also in the Nixon case, they were both had just been reelected with huge majorities.
Second term, yeah. I mean, Watergate had started to break in 1972.
But it was very quiet.
It was still the third-rate burglary or whatever.
Right. But, you know, it was a year and a half later when it hit the fan on that. And it did hit the fan.
And the reason it's a little frustrating, because on the one hand you think, well, okay, these are state officials. They can or cannot comment on national issues as they choose. Mm-hmm. But all the statewide elected officials, with the exception of the Secretary of State, are on President Trump's reelection committee. Governor Mike DeWine is the chairman, the titular chairman for Ohio for the reelect Donald Trump. So it's like, and we have asked him, you know, well, okay, take off your gubernatorial hat because you've put your name, you're allowing your name to be distributed to presumably give some heft to the Trump reelection campaign by lending your name to this effort. Will you speak to Trump? He just won't go there. He will not defend the president. I mean, I don't know if you can make hay with that or not.
He won't defend him, but he won't trash him either.
He doesn't want to talk about it.
Yeah. He's just, and Governor DeWine, of course, cast an impeachment vote before. Mm-hmm. He voted to impeach President Clinton in the late 90s when he was in Washington, a member of Congress. So this is an elite of Ohio who's had experience in dealing with these cases. He has taken a stand before on what constitutes an impeachable offense in his mind. All we can do is ask. We don't have, subpoena power or the truth serum. Journalists, we can just ask for the public. And I don't know if the public doesn't care. Then the public doesn't care.
The public didn't care that much at this stage of the Nixon proceedings either.
True.
I do think an interesting Ohio angle to this are three different Ohio congressmen.
There is Jim Jordan, let's see,
Mike
Turner, and Brad Wenstrup, who has been very pushy. Mm-hmm. Jim Jordan obviously wins the prize for that, but...
Yeah, so it's interesting. Obviously, all three of them are certainly started setting themselves up as supporters of the president,
right,
defenders of the president. And I think that will come back in the 2020 races and, the next time they're on the ballot. And, that will certainly endear some people to them. And I certainly will not endear them to other people. And especially, I think, has triggered some challengers for Jim Jordan. I know both sides are fundraising off of this effort. So it's interesting.
Chris Gibbs, a 61-year-old farmer in Shelby County, he's launching an exploratory committee to weigh a campaign against Jordan. He has his problems with the administration and with Jordan start with the tariffs. And Gibbs was a supporter of Trump. He voted for Trump and he was an outspoken supporter. And now he's changed course on that. And there is looks like there are cracks in the plaster of the, the agricultural industry in the country. And it's been a while now. They're being hurt by this.
That's a big Trump base that could swing the other way because of the policies of the administration.
And we should add that my colleague Rick Ruan wrote in our Capital Insider column Sunday about how the performance of Congressman Jordan has actually increased the fundraising for his Democratic opponents. Those of you who watch West Wing, Now, who listening to public radio would have watched West Wing, right? That Venn diagram overlaps a lot.
Now that it's on Netflix.
Bradley Whitford, remember him, you know. He just tweeted out, you know, from the impeachment hearings, who is running against this guy, meaning Jim Jordan? And, the one of the candidate from Ohio, she says,
a Democrat,
well, I am.
Right?
Yeah, I am. And she started getting contributions from across the country. And let's face it, though, Jim Jordan's district is as safe as any in Ohio.
He's got well over $1 million in the bank. But it does say something that she raised $60,000 or $80,000 in a matter of hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After posting that, she posted, I am, along with a link to her fundraising. Mm-hmm.
This is your 15 seconds, and she took advantage of it.
Yeah.
Speaking of 15 seconds, I think that's what these hearings have become, is that an opportunity to grandstand and kind of create that tweetable moment. And so I think that's what we're seeing with, it's interesting, PBS NewsHour, their YouTube channel, they separate every single congressperson's line of questioning. So if you wanted to see everything that Jim Jordan said to Gordon Sondland, you could find that video clip. And so it's been an interesting development to see how each person in Congress takes their time with their line of questioning. Some people have really deep, thoughtful questions trying to get to the matter of things. Some people are kind of going for that big home run moment.
Mm-hmm. And have no questions at all.
But just want to get that tweetable moment.
Do you see Democrats and or Republicans using footage from these going forward into this election cycle that we'll be knee deep in a matter of weeks at this point?
It's possible, especially on the Jim Jordan front. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, some of the clips of that make it into some sort of
something
ads
other than
or something
Saturday Night
like
Live.
That.
Yeah.
Brad Wenstrup is a pretty safe seat down there in the Cincinnati area. The more interesting race, as always, will be the first, which is Steve Chabot, who's the incumbent in a district that is, you know, leaning more and more Democratic every day.
Suburban, so, therefore. It's more suburban.
It is more suburban. It'll be really interesting after redistricting. I think it'll be hard to have two Republican districts in Hamilton County again. Mm.
I think using clips for campaigns might work better in other states, but in Ohio, it's just such a touchy subject where you don't really know which constituency goes which way or the other.
Right.
So I wonder if it would work in other states, but maybe not so much in Ohio. Whereas somebody like Jim Jordan, he probably doesn't need to run the clips because everybody who lives in his – everybody knows where Jim Jordan stands on these things and his district knows. If anybody got to listen to WSU reporter Nick Evans' story on Jim Jordan, he has a strong grip on that district and a lot of voters love him there. And so I think this just kind of continues what people in his district already know about him.
Yeah, so in theory, you know, Mike Turner's district would be the only thing close to a swing district among these three, so it'll depend off his opponent has any money. And, you know, the other thing is we still don't know how this is all going to turn out. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now it looks like...
Yeah, it's not over.
The House is going to impeach. Mm-hmm. It seems a given. And the Senate will not convict. So Trump will stay in office. That seems a given. So, okay. And that could all happen by February.
A trial could be very much different, though, than impeachment hearings.
Yes, no question. But so that's why, I mean, that's part of the unpredictability. But what I'm saying is we'll know the answer to all these questions about how it came out by the Iowa primary, presumably. And then what? Then we've got presumably, again, if it goes the way that everyone seems to be predicting, we'll have a president who was impeached but not removed from office running for re-election. And will any of these charges back and forth be resolved? Will there be further issues? You know, how does this play with voters?
We'll find out next year.
We will
stay
find
tuned.
Out. Stay tuned. Stand by. Stay tuned for more weekly reporter roundtables and keep your eyes glued to the newspapers and the news outlets of your choice.
And, of course, one of the dynamics that has been mentioned nationally is a Senate trial is going to be coming probably in that month leading up to the Iowa primary. So.
And, you know, we don't know what that Senate trial is going to consist of. We're still waiting. I mean, we just don't know. We won't know.
Well, reportedly last week, there was an effort to just outright dismiss it out of hand at the beginning. Then they, you know, the leader said, well, we at least have to have a trial. But, you know, you've got from, you know, Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, you know, Senator Booker, you've got active senators who are going to be tied up in Washington, not being able to campaign. But Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden and a lot of others will be able to.
And would they find it important to, like, abstain from that? Like, should they sit out because they're running to replace his job?
We shall see. Jesse Ballmer of the Cincinnati Inquirer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks as well.
Thanks, and thanks for this is the first Ann Fisher show with two members of the Gannett reporting team on together.
Oh, my gosh, that's right.
So a little bit of history here.
Is being made.
And happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Be grateful.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.